fourth and final installment in our discussion of three-dimensional astrology. I am grateful for your continued participation. So, life begins at rock bottom. Your life cannot have meaning until you have been through the dark night of the soul. It was an early Christian ascetic, St. John of the Cross, who first coined this phrase in a poem which described the gradual spiritual tempering of the human soul as it moved closer to God. But even though this particular description has been attributed to a Christian tradition, it describes nonetheless a ubiquitous human journey that is a process of spiritual life within all human cultures. St. John himself was borrowing the idea from earlier writers like Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle. The idea that life begins at rock bottom is as old as civilization itself. The first insight you can glean from this, then, if you are yourself at rock bottom, is that you are embarking upon the human spiritual journey. It is not unique to you. It is not unique to your culture. It is a shared bond of experience with all human beings throughout all time. The path that you take, the path as described by the three-dimensional map of your astrology, will be entirely unique to you, but the impetus to walk it and the destination are shared by all. Perhaps now you will begin to understand, within this precise paradigm, why it is that astrology ultimately fails as a material study. Material reality is the shadow cast by the spiritual body, and like a shadow, it has no features, only a vague outline. We can divine certain dimensions of material life from the shadow, but we cannot determine the face or aspect of it. The texture is lost. Similarly, while you are living from the ego, there is no texture to your life either. It is the same shadow of meaning that is cast, and while it will have dimension, it will not have depth. The dark night of the soul is the point of ego collapse, where you are given the opportunity to see depth and texture for the first time. Resistance to seeing life in this way is usually vehement, but many manage to avoid it altogether. But those who do cannot ever know meaning, and therefore are incapable of experiencing true joy in their lives. It is that simple. And there is no denying the reality that for the majority of us, the long dark night of the soul begins around midlife. What do we mean by midlife? Well, in my view, it is a period of time that is, for the most part, circumscribed by the age of 32 or 33, right between when the Saturn return has bedded in and the third Jupiter return, around the age of 36, is on the horizon, and the Chiron return at age 50. In our culture, we hear Jung's mantra for this period, and it is given the name midlife crisis, which unfortunately conveys a rather shabby impression of his meaning. For when Jung first talked about this process, he in fact delineated a crisis which necessitated the adoption of a new paradigm. His view was that the midlife crisis was something to be welcomed because it revolutionized one's perspective to allow for greater richness and joy in life. Without the crisis, there could not be improvement. Of course, those of us who study Jung and astrology are well aware of the fact that Jung was a keen astrologer himself and understood that the universal symbols of astrology offered profound insight into the human condition. Indeed, Jung once said that a psychologist without astrology is akin to a sailor without a compass, likely to lose his way. But of course, because of the myopia of materialism, he was reluctant to be too open about from whence much of his theory of archetypes was derived. In Jung's view, the midlife crisis which materialists see as an aberration, is a spiritual opportunity. And of course, his inclusion of the concept of a revolution of thinking offers another clue to his astrological heritage, since undoubtedly the most compelling astrological event that we can associate with midlife is the Uranus half return between the ages of 38 and 42. In Jung's view, and mine, a human life post 42, which holds the same values and positions as it did pre 38, is a missed opportunity. So the process begins astrologically with the third Jupiter return. After the Saturn return, but just as Jupiter is coming back to its birth position within the chart. I see each return as a winding of the spring, building greater pressure and momentum. At 12, there is a change of perspective as horizons broaden to encompass the passage into adolescence. At 24, the adult life is just beginning, and education is at last being applied, leading to opportunity. The age of 36 is the point where maturity is established. One is at the height of one's powers, and normally, historically at least, families are growing, careers established, but there is still plenty of energy left to make new plans, normally with the resources at hand to make things happen. 36 is typically a good age, but everything changes within a few short years. For current generations, those with Pluto in Leo and Virgo particularly, the Pluto squares come early and are often the first real challenges of the midlife period. This is quickly followed by the Neptune squares, the Uranus half return, the second Saturn opposition, and the Chiron return at 50. If we follow this trail, we can see that the control needs of Pluto are first challenged between the ages of 36 and 80, depending upon when you were born. For my father, his Pluto squares hit at the age of 48, for me at 38, and for my son Teddy, they will occur at the age of 78. Lucky Ted. Then there are the Neptune squares, which dissolve the ego needs. Then the Uranus half return, which simply changes the game and puts you at odds with and at a distance from those things that you once thought mattered. When you get perspective, real 10,000-yard perspective on your own positionality, that's when you see how true it is. It's no real wonder that lives fall into crisis during midlife, because every material tenet upon which you have based your existence is being challenged at this time. It's really easy to move through midlife without inner turmoil when you understand these things, because you know that you only have to let go of your ego and control needs, and the spiritual dimension will have space to grow into. It's a beautiful process to witness, and I have seen it with many people, most especially in my work, which is primarily involved with people from their early 30s into their early 50s, people who are midlifing. It's a far more important phase of maturation and development than adolescence, because it has so much more happening. But in fact, the adolescent phase contains these same patterns in miniature. There is the first Jupiter return at 12, the first Saturn opposition at 14, and this period culminates with the first Uranus square at 21. But it is not, even so, nearly as intense and urgent as the midlife period. The issue here is that people assume that once they have passed 21, they're all grown up. Now they're an adult, there's nothing left to do except to carry on being sensible and grown up. In fact, you're only materially grown up at this time. The biggest step of all is yet to come, and then society labels this most important of all human stages of development a mere crisis. You'll lose your head for a bit, run off with the secretary, buy a sports car, and then you'll get over it and go back to being sensible and grown up again. Now that's a calamity. The calamity is not in losing your home, your career, your marriage, although those events may well be extremely testing. The calamity is in not letting go of your ego's control needs. There is nothing worse than seeing somebody in the throes of midlife revolution trying to control, play the victim, rationalize their ego issues, and fall back into materiality. See what I said there? Control, Pluto, play the victim, Neptune, rationalise, Uranus, and fall back into materiality, Saturn. It works this way because this is the process which breaks down the ego. For those that fight tooth and nail against allowing joy into their lives, and plenty of people do, the Chiron return can be utterly devastating. Their unexamined issues start to rear up like the ghostly phantoms of Christmas past and present, and maybe they have one final throw of the dice to look forward to at 58 to 60, the second Saturn return. So we can say that essentially, the long dark night of the soul begins, faintly and tentatively, around the age of 30. It reaches a crescendo in the early 40s, and it is a done deal, for better or worse, as 60 comes around. Now, some will say that they are more inclined toward the spiritual, even though they are not yet at the midlife period of life, and this is true enough. People particularly who have strong Pisces or Scorpio placements, and by that I also mean to include 8th and 12th house placements, Pluto and Neptune placements, these people often evince a facility with spiritual or intangible concepts at an early age. However, the midlife experience is still required for these people to truly uncover the paradigm of meaning in their life. They might have a better grasp of the methods, therefore, but it is only when those methods need to be applied under pressure that they have value. This is one of the many conundrums of human character within the context of these discussions. Some people appear to be fine and upstanding, and all might be well, but we realise when disaster strikes that they were in fact operating within a comfort zone which did not challenge them to dig deep. True depth of character, then, can only be meaningfully measured in times of crisis. And it's very often true that the unlikeliest of people make good in a crisis, while others, normally dependable types, fail utterly to show any character when tested in this way. This is often the hallmark of the Plutonic character, in fact, because they bury their anxieties and insecurities very deep, only to have them erupt when they are truly tested. And we've all seen the grim wasteland that is left when Pluto has run amok. The danger without outer planet transits, major outer planet transits, is that you fall into the trap of hubris. Now, we all understand hubris as being a type of extreme arrogance, but to the ancient Greeks, hubris had a more specific quality, which was, specifically, literally, comparing oneself to the gods. The myths are littered with tales whose key premise is the consequence of hubris. There's the story of Arachne, or, for example, there is the story of Niobe, who compared her child-rearing and child-bearing skills, she had 14 children, to Leto, who had only two, although they were Apollo and Artemis, so there's some contention around the theme of quality versus quantity in this case. Even so, Niobe was punished by Leto for her hubris. She ordered Artemis and Apollo to murder her children. All 14 of them. Taking on the aspects of the gods, then, comparing oneself with the gods, or acting with the impunity of the gods, is what is classically termed hubris, and it is one of the traps of the ego. It is the ego which believes itself godlike, and it is the unchecked ego, therefore, which brings down the wrath of the gods. We can relate this to astrology directly, because the outer planet transits offer up the ego traps of hubris according to their intrinsic nature. With Uranus, there is the trap of rationalising. Now, we all know that the human mind can rationalise anything in all creation. The human mind can rationalise ethnic cleansing, murder, theft, anything, and it can go even further than making these aberrations seem inevitable. It can make them into acts of heroism. Uranus says, "I'm doing this for your own good. I'm doing this for the sake of the children. This is going to hurt me more than it hurts you." So thus speaks Uranus, and so the hubris begins. Then there is the professional victim that is Neptune, who says, it's okay for me to do this because that person made me suffer. If they hadn't treated me so badly, then I wouldn't be forced to take this step. Or, I'm not responsible for this situation because they hurt me first. And finally, there is Pluto, who's the hardest of all to take back. Pluto says, this is a matter of principle, so I'm never going to change my mind. Pluto is very principled, by the way. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, remember. One of Pluto's greatest statements is, I'm doing this for the sake of the children. And of course, perhaps in a less sinister manner, Pluto will also say things like, it's not personal, it's just business. All these states lead to hubris, and just as pride goes before a fall, so hubris goes before a collapse. I believe that this is another system of human soul processing, just as much as the dark night of the soul, as defined by St. John. When we are given an opportunity to behave badly and get away with it, some people will take that opportunity, and then it's as though the gods chuckle and offer you, or offer them, another opportunity to do it again, perhaps this time taking it a little further. This is why integrity is so important. Otherwise, you'll keep abusing the opportunity, keep on failing the test of integrity. Eventually, you'll have followed the trail of breadcrumbs into hubris. People can become mad with power, even in very trivial and petty situations. We've all seen that happening. It's as though the gods are wondering how far this person will go, and they are led into hubris, realizing only at the last that they have wandered into a vale of tears. They have allowed themselves to court ruin because they could not resist the temptation. We're seeing this right now in the phone hacking scandal in the UK. There are some respectable and well-regarded people in the mix here. Andy Coulson was an advisor to the Prime Minister of Great Britain, so clearly he was considered a man of principle and character. But it would be wrong to say that he was just bad. He couldn't have been so well-regarded if he'd just been bad to the bone. No. What happened was that he was given an opportunity to get away with something. Maybe it was just a case of having to turn a blind eye to something he knew wasn't strictly right, but because he wasn't doing it himself, that was probably okay. It was a grey area. So the trail of breadcrumbs begins. Of course, had he been tasked with hacking the private correspondence of a 12-year-old schoolgirl in Act 1, Scene 1, he would have balked. But it is the small, steady erosion of integrity that leads those who don't necessarily start out being bad people into a state of hubris. Looked at in this way, it's easy to see why the basic currency of a spiritual life is unshakable integrity. And let's be clear, that's integrity for yourself. Yourself. Not anyone else. It's not your job to police other people's integrity, because that is Uranus getting in on the act. You cannot control anyone or anything outside of yourself, and to believe that you can is ascribing to yourself divine powers. It's more hubris. So, personal integrity is the safeguard against hubris. What that means is, if you have the slightest qualm about your action, then examine it. If you're telling somebody else what to do, then examine it. If you believe that you're hard done by, then examine it. These are all the gateways to hubris and your own ruin. And let us not forget that you are undoubtedly hurting others in the process. Above all else, I don't want you to take my word for this. Go away and examine the principles that I've laid out here, and see for yourself whether or not they are true. I am confident that you'll soon discover the universal veracity of these ideas. One of the reasons that I know these ideas are true is because they're not my ideas. I have certainly contemplated them deeply enough, and for long enough, that I've been able to apply my understanding of astrological principles to these established spiritual truths, and then to have made a series of correlations between them which clarify and focus the fundamental nature of astrology as nothing else has. These are not my ideas. These ideas are as old as mankind. Integrity is a model of internal consistency that is necessary for spiritual growth. The key component here is consistency, and being consistent means that you follow the rule even if it is to your disadvantage to do so. An example of this can be found herein. Most people base their self-concept of integrity on the simple condition that they do not tell lies. Now, one person that I know bought a Land Rover, an off-road vehicle, from somebody else, and later discovered that it had been driven carelessly by the previous owner, so that the vehicle's chassis was twisted and the cost of repair exceeded the value of the vehicle. This person then decided that his best course of action was to sell the vehicle on without mentioning the defect. His rationalization was that the previous owner had sold it to him without admitting the problem, so it would have been unfair for him to suffer because of another person's lack of integrity. This is Neptune. He is the victim of somebody else, so why does he deserve to suffer? I'm quite sure the person he sold the vehicle to would have been thinking the same thing due to him. Conversely, a person of integrity would not have been able to sell the vehicle without mentioning the problem, because that would have been the only consistently honest approach. The philosopher Immanuel Kant called this principle a categorical imperative. A categorical imperative is something which is an absolute motivator for action rather than a relative one. What does that mean? Well, a hypothetical imperative is one which causes you to do something or not do something according to the circumstance. For example, if you are tired, the hypothetical imperative would cause you to go to bed and catch up on some sleep. But if you weren't tired, then that wouldn't be necessary. A categorical imperative, by contrast, is one that would cause you to do something or not do something regardless of the circumstance. So according to Kant, the basis of human ethics is entirely dependent upon categorical imperatives. You do not steal, and you do not make exceptions to the rule of not stealing, because human nature being what it is, there is always a means of rationalizing theft. Not stealing must therefore be a categorical imperative, otherwise it is a hypothetical imperative, and because people can rationalize their own self-interest, without a categorical imperative, then stealing simply becomes the norm. All of this is Kant's means of expressing the same concept. Kant believed that you should not make exceptions to the code unless you were prepared to live in a society without the moral code itself. What that means is, if you're not prepared to tell the person that you're selling the vehicle to that it has a fault, then you shouldn't expect to be treated any better than anyone else. Put way more simply then, Kant's maxim says that if you're prepared to cheat, then you shouldn't complain about being cheated. In fact, you should expect it. So, if you want a life of meaning, you need to be honest about the problem with the Land Rover. If the Land Rover had instead included a bonus feature, such as some kind of expensive engine upgrade which wasn't reflected in the price, this person would have marvelled at his good fortune and would happily have mentioned it in his sales pitch and profited from it. So the insight here is very easy. If you are a person of integrity, you stick to your rule, regardless of whether it works to your advantage or not, and regardless of anybody else's rules of conduct. By justifying your dishonesty on the basis of somebody else's dishonesty, neither makes you honest, nor does it make society a pleasant place to live. Indeed, it only assures that you live in a dishonest world. And this is a very clear example of how integrity works. Without consistency, it's not integrity. So while we can rationalize our exceptions to our rules of integrity in this way, which is Uranus at work, it's often easier to employ Neptune in this role, Here's an example of how Neptune gets the job done, or tries to. A while back, I went into a store and bought a bottle of wine, quite fittingly for a Neptune story. After I'd left the store, I realised the shop assistant had given me too much change, a whole £5 too much, in fact. When I turned to go back into the store, my friend, who was with me on that evening, tried to dissuade me from returning the money, and his argument centred upon three key bases. One, because the extra money had been freely given to me, it was not stealing. Two, because the money belonged to a business, no individual would suffer as a result. And three, it was an act of good fortune for which I bore no personal responsibility. All of these seem like good arguments, until you apply the consistency rule. In my view, and in Kant's model of categorical imperatives, the £5 did not belong to me, and the means by which it came into my possession does not change this fact. It is only a matter of style, actually, between being given this thing that is not mine by mistake, or taking it at gunpoint. It's still not mine to have. The categorical imperative, therefore, must be, if it is not mine, I will return it. It is only the hypothetical imperative that says, if something is given to me by mistake, then I can keep it. Mistake is Neptunian, right? It was a mistake, so I bear no responsibility for it. Of course, if that's the world you want to live in, then you shouldn't complain if the bank makes a mistake and loses all your savings. We create the world we live in through our personal codes of behaviour. This principle is well known, and it's known as an attractor field. If you're a cheat and a liar, you tend to be drawn into situations and circumstances where cheating and lying is the norm. Every human soul eventually finds their field. So, Immanuel Kant, St. John of the Cross, this idea of a spiritual mode of apprehending life and reality is as old as time. In my view, the Greek philosopher Socrates expressed this principle most poignantly when he said that the unexamined life is not worth living. He was on trial for his life at the time, so it was quite an urgent matter. He had been accused of heresy because certain people were becoming uncomfortable with the manner in which he questioned their integrity. What this really intimates is that the men of power in Athens were irritated by his searching insights into their motives. So they accused him of being a corrupter of minds and a heretic, a brainwasher of the young, essentially, and therefore a dangerous man. They were only doing it for the sake of the children, you see. When he was told that he should stop looking into matters so deeply, he made this immortal statement, "The unexamined life is not worth living." He said this, and it seems with hindsight that it held a double truth for Socrates. He was on the one hand positing a view of the nature of human life, while at the same time telling his detractors that if you were not allowed to examine life deeply, then they might as well sentence him to death. What Socrates was saying is that life without meaning is meaningless. It sounds like some kind of crazy circular logic, doesn't it? But it only sounds that way because without this matter of integrity, life cannot have meaning as we understand, and therefore, without integrity, according to Socrates, you may as well be dead. The truth of that statement is only self-evident to those who have crossed the threshold into integrity, and those people are very few in number, perhaps only a little more than 1 in 10 people alive today. Because the majority do not understand what integrity is, what meaning is, they have no benchmark against which to measure how fulfilling their life is. If those people were given an insight into meaning, then they would have a major problem on their hands, because they would viscerally appreciate the depth of their own misery. But it is an impossible perspective, because without self-awareness, there can be no appreciation of self. Life is entirely instinctive. The crazed chauffeur is at the wheel, but they don't know it. They think they're driving. Now, if you remember the last episode, you will also remember the story of Sandy, who I spoke to while out in the city of Norwich. Sandy believed that because he had spent his time drinking and working, and had subsequently missed out on his children growing up, that he was a failure. that his life had been a bad job, and all there was for him was to carry on as best he could, living with the knowledge of his mistakes and reconciling his regrets. But what Sandy was really saying as he related his story is that for those lost years, his failure had been to not examine his life. He simply lived according to his compulsions and never questioned them. And we should not be surprised to learn that Sandy began to awaken to this new perspective in his early 40s. Up until then, he had just accepted the habits and patterns that he had gone on with during his life. He had got into the grooves and never questioned them. He'd assumed that he was driving the car and never even noticed the crazed chauffeur. Then he went through a crisis. His wife left him, and for a while he felt bitter and angry. He felt like a victim. But eventually, when he began to emerge from the long dark night, he found that there was a new awareness. He began to examine the patterns and habits of his life, and he began to take responsibility for his situation. He stopped blaming, and he started living with integrity and self-awareness. Life was very different for Sandy after this. He stopped drinking. He gradually established a relationship with his two sons, and he became an authentic and loving human being. But even so, he could not entirely forgive himself for living an unexamined life for the first 40 or so years of his time on this earth. Suddenly he knew where he was within the map of his life, but he could not quite forgive himself for not being in the driving seat for all that time. And this is the challenge for all of us. We, astrologically aware people, are at an enormous spiritual advantage if we can put all of these elements together, discover the process that awakens and illuminates the human soul, and apply those natural laws to our life situation. Now, we really have something to work with. We know where we are because we have astrology. We know how to make progress because we understand the spiritual law of integrity. We know that we are going to suffer and go through the long dark night of the soul because that is the gateway to meaning. Knowing all of this, we are no longer able to be victims of out-there-ness because everything that happens to us is an instrument of divine law that is offering us the olive branch of awakening to ourselves. That is the evidence of a loving God and a benign universe. But none of this can become real for us unless we are prepared to take the step of examining our lives and taking personal responsibility for our situation. With astrology, you are at an enormous advantage because the unexamined life is right there, writ in stark red and blue lines on the map of our nativity. That red line between Neptune and the Sun is telling you that while you're not driving, you're probably going to be in this groove. And how does that work? It probably works through obfuscation. With Mercury-Neptune, for example, Mercury-Neptune unexamined is compulsive obfuscation. You have a tendency to slip out of the grip of situations by creating a story. The facts aren't so important because they can be sidestepped just a little. Mercury-Neptune, Mercury in Pisces, to some extent Mercury in the 12th house. With this situation, you're not so much responsible for what happened as you are a victim of it. But then, when you go through the metamorphosis of spiritual awakening and adopt integrity, you have the great gift of insight to enable you to see, by dint of that bold red line, that this is a groove that you need to examine. Not because you want the material payoff of having a rather romantic manner of relating, but because you no longer want to distort meaning through omitting facts and insights. You don't want, or in fact need, to communicate your victim's story. Instead, you want to communicate your faith, your belief in loving kindness and compassion. That's the gift of astrology. Those lines on your map are opportunities, but rather ironically, you cannot convert them into material benefit without first realizing the conundrum of materialism. Cannot bring you happiness until you have shifted paradigms, and when you have become spiritually motivated, it ceases to be an incentive. So what I'm saying is that our nativity is as interchangeable as our perspective on the material spiritual scale. While we are in the material, operating from hypothetical imperatives, maintaining only the appearance of integrity, then we are subject to the compulsions of our astrology. It runs our life, not us. Through making the transition into self-awareness, integrity and meaning, we gradually begin to take back control of our nativity and we can rise above it. Enlightenment is nothing more than mastering our nativity. Because we can see very clearly the grooves, we can avoid them, but only once we have adopted this paradigm. The unexamined life is not worth living because it is not actually living. And this too is part of the process. Because when we are young, we fall into that groove for the first time and it's novel. With the Mercury-Neptune groove, making your victim statement for the first time is probably quite gratifying because it's new and people are feeling sorry for us and we get some concessions that way. We get the payoff through weaving a story that isn't slavishly tied to the actual Saturnine reality of things, and that's a good feeling. We got something for nothing there, so we decide that we're going to use that shortcut again, and so it goes. But 20 years later, we're no longer getting the juice from using the groove. We just got into that habit. We fell into the groove so many thousands of times that we stopped being aware of it, and all we know now is that we're miserable because life isn't fair and something is missing. What we don't see is that while we're stuck in that non-integrous pattern, we're generating an attractor field, and it's drawing in other unhappy people who also aren't too worried about the absolute veracity of what they're talking about either. They're victims too. And now we're all competing to see who can be the biggest victim. Suddenly, life has lost its colour, its vivacity, its richness. We feel tired, and we remember a better time when we were enthusiastic and full of the joy of possibility, and then bang! We're no longer certain of anything, and the chances are we're somewhere in our early to mid-40s. It's so predictable that it's kind of funny. It beggars belief that most everyone hasn't been able to join up the dots, and they do not see the broader process, instead acknowledging only a period of aberration which must merely be weathered before normality returns. So, understanding this, what does it mean for astrology? This is the crux of the matter, and these perspectives and philosophies are not trivial in any field of endeavour, least of all in astrology, because once we come to accept that the goal of a human life is wholly immaterial, that man is a spiritual animal, simply waiting to emerge through this process, through the caterpillar time before integrity, then through the chrysalis time and into spiritual awareness, then we come to the immediate and experiential realization that life will never be the same again. Any human soul that has been reborn into the ineffable sees life differently. However, the view from below, from the material, will be that one has taken leave of sense and reason, and at best, that one has put on rose-tinted eyeglasses. In fact, the opposite is true. One has actually taken off the grey-tinted eyeglasses and is seeing life in its true spectrum at last. For the first time, you can see, touch, and feel reality. Astrology then cannot help but be transformed by this, because you are able to understand that every soul, unbeknownst to its ego, for every soul has its ego, is working towards its salvation. You should imagine that your ego is the harsh and self-serving master, and your soul the bonded serf, always hoping for emancipation. Therefore, as an astrologer, using the nativity for its intended purpose, you are working like William Wilberforce for the abolition of slavery, one case at a time. This underlines the fact already stated that there are two astrologies. The first, the most common, is material astrology, and it works to some extent because the soul casts a shadow into reality. We can extrapolate likely outcomes based upon unconscious patterns delineated within planetary patterns and constructs. that these material realities are only the effects of deeper spiritual causes. They are the material symptoms of a spiritual malaise. This is why I try to work only as a spiritual astrologer, helping people who are in a state of crisis. There are other astrologers who work more in the field of fortune telling, in material astrology, which is, in my humble view, only likely to give astrology a bad name. Indeed, when I work in my own practice, this dichotomy is easy to spot. One or two questions usually elicit the condition of the ego-soul tension very succinctly. A couple of weeks ago, a man visited me for a consultation. He was a charming man and had travelled a fair distance and seemed expectant. I talked to him for a little while and I saw that there were some considerable tensions within the scope of his work and career situation, and asked him what he did to ameliorate those tensions. At this, he began to tell me about how he loved nothing more than to go on long foreign holidays and lie on a beach in the sun. He had a very close Neptune square to a Leo sun. There really was no better expression of lying on the beach in the sun, looking out at the sea with a drink in hand, than that. His sun Neptune square was his entire life. For me, this was a very difficult case, because here was a person living through the material exclusively. Now, the only way that I had of giving this man what he wanted to attempt was to attempt to extrapolate likely material effects from his ego position, as indicated for the most part by the solar quality in his nativity. Until this man had been through the dark night of the soul, though, and crucially been transformed by it, there was nothing to tell him. I could see that he would likely have two marriages, and that he had been distant from his father, who, although a big character, was evasive and unfulfilled, through no fault of his own, of course. But beyond these generalisations, I could not talk to him about his soul life, because he didn't yet have one. And this is the true fit-for-purpose application of astrology. Because this man's life was unexamined, there was nothing of particular import to relay to him. His life was a collection of material trivia, nothing more. All he really wanted to know was if anything unexpectedly wonderful was going to happen to him. He didn't want to grow spiritually or emotionally because those fields of experience were intrinsically meaningless to him. He only wanted to grow materially. Because he could do no more about that than carry on working for a monthly wage, what he actually wanted to know was whether or not some material boon was going to fall out of the sky and land on his head at some point in the near future. And what more than that can material astrology be? Well, of course, there is a middle ground. And this middle ground is the no man's land between ego and soul, between ambition and meaning, between the material and the spiritual. When the sun begins to set on the bright days of youth and the midlife darkness descends, then there are methods, insights and techniques which spiritual astrology can utilise to light the way. The map of astrology can be illuminated to give the two-dimensional terrain of the old life a new depth and texture so that the future becomes bright with possibility once more. But until the courage and certainty to move forward into the darkness, combined with the painful necessity to confront disaster and ruin, have built sufficient pressure in the soul to begin the metamorphic transition, the map of astrology must remain superficial and obscure. The depth is forged in the crucible of adversity and self-doubt, and out of it, integrity and spiritual awareness is born.